Hi there, you're listening to Tunch Ilgin, captain of Cyprus Hockey, and you're listening to Half Court Press Podcast.
Hi, my name's Sarah Jameson. I'm a Scotland hockey player and I play for Watsonians Hockey Club.
Hi, this is Greg McKenzie of Inverleith and the Scotland senior indoor team, and you are listening to the Half Court Press with Neil McLeod.
Coach's Corner is the latest series from the Half Court Press podcast. Here, Teo McLeod chats to a variety of coaches from different sports about what it is they do. We chat about coaching philosophies and techniques, youth development and team preparation, as well as how the individual fits into these concepts. If you're curious about coaching, then this is the podcast for you.
Hi, this is Tom Barton of Inverleith Hockey Club and the Cyprus Senior Men's National Team, and you are listening to the Half Court Press podcast with your fantastic host, Teo McLeod.
Hello, and welcome back to the Half Court Press podcast. You join us today with someone who is actually an avid listener of the show, and my boss at Inverleith Hockey Club, a man of many hats and coaching roles, Tom Barton.
Hello there. It is an absolute pleasure to take this audience with Teo McLeod.
Tom, can you give a little introduction about yourself, please?
Yes. First and foremost, I've been told repeatedly that I talk too much. So I'm enjoying the challenge of coming on a podcast and trying to keep myself succinct. Yeah, my name's Tom. I'm from Edinburgh and I coach field hockey. I have a complete cocktail of coaching roles. I am a senior international head coach. I lead the Cyprus senior men's team across outdoor 11-a-side, indoor hockey and hockey fives. I'm an adult club coach and I'm co-leading the Inverleith ladies ones in the outdoor premiership. And Inverleith is a local side here in Edinburgh. And I'm also a youth club head coach at Inverleith, and I lead on a variety of ages and stages in that I'm involved from under 8s to under 18s, and I'm involved in both performance and participation programs. So, yeah, no, I coach domestically and internationally. I coach performance and participation. I coach kids and adults, and I coach every format of the game except beach hockey. So, yes, you're right, that is far too much hockey. And any beach hockey enthusiasts out there listening, I am keen for completing the full set of formats. So if anyone's got any beach hockey offers, please fire them my way.
Will you be sending me down to Portobello Beach in Edinburgh to lead the first iteration of Scottish League?
I mean, as much as I'm keen to maybe complete the set and become a beach hockey coach, I don't think Scotland is maybe the starting opportunity for that. I think we'd probably have a few blue toes and frowning faces if we asked people to get down to Portobello on a Sunday morning for some beach hockey.
Now, I believe that your official role at Inverleith is, are you the vice president of Inverleith Hockey Club in charge of youth hockey? Is that your
Yes, so as well as having an absolute cocktail of coaching roles, I also have a club development role in that I am our youth vice president, who is in charge of our youth section. So my main role is setting the direction for the youth section, to trying to be a guardian of somewhat of a sort of business plan for the youth section. Where are we going? What are we trying to do? And then making sure that we have all the people in place to deliver what we do as a youth section.
So you do that. That's one of your main roles. You are also the women's first team coach.
Correct.
Well, co-coach, isn't it? With
co-coach, yes. So I'm part of a collective of coaches who coach our ladies' ones. So a shout out to Sean, Greg and Ben, who lead with me with our ladies' ones.
Is that Greg McKenzie, who has also been on this podcast?
That is previous Half Court Press darling, Greg McKenzie, indeed.
And the women's first team play in the Scottish Premiership?
Mm-hmm.
Indoor and outdoor, I believe?
Indoor and outdoor, yes.
And your Cypriot men's coach, who I believe they are in the Euro Hockey Championships 4th Division. Is that right?
That is correct. We are 56th in the world, We compete in a number of different formats, and we compete in outdoor 11-a-side. And for that, we're in the fourth division. The way European hockey works is that you have a number of different divisions, and if you win your division, you come back in the next iteration of the tournament in the higher division, and the ultimate aim is to get promoted to the A division and win that, and you are the champion of Europe. We play in the Indo Europeans, which similarly have divisions, and we are again in the bottom division of European indoor hockey. And then we play in Hockey Fives, which is a new format that the FIH have introduced, which is five-a-side hockey and four outfield and a goalkeeper on a small outfield pitch. And we are in the A division for that, mainly due to the fact that not many nations play. So there isn't really enough to split it into multiple divisions, but we are currently in the A division for Hockey Fives.
With indoor hockey, of course, being six-a-side,
Indoor hockey six-a-side, correct.
which is the preference for the Half Court Press podcast in terms of the shorthand version of the game.
I agree. I love indoor. I think for me, I am an indoor activist in the sense that I think if we're looking to find a format to push alongside 11-a-side hockey, I think indoor is the choice because when you think about growing the game globally, you need a format which is easy to get into schools. Every school has a hole, or at least has access to a hole. And you also need a format which is able to be played in any type of weather condition. A lot of countries you can't play in the heat of the day because it's, far too hot to be outside playing. So indoor for me ticks the box for growing the game. It is able to get into schools anywhere in the world. It can be played anywhere in the world because it's inside. It makes use of existing infrastructure, so there's no need to build new pitches, put in floodlights, build new courts. You can use school halls, handball courts, basketball courts, and it's also a fast-paced, exciting game. So I think it ticks the boxes for a shorthand format of the game where the focus is trying to develop the number of people playing hockey globally. I think it's a sport you can definitely take to the world.
And doesn't it need to be played indoor? I think we should just change the name to six-a-side hockey or hockey.
I think you're spot on. It could definitely be played outdoor, car parks, hockey pitches. You can definitely play the same version of the game.
So, a little bit more of an introduction about yourself. Where are you from? How old are you? How long have you been coaching?
So I'm from Edinburgh. I was born in England, but moved up to Scotland when I was 18 months old. So born in England, raised in Scotland. So I identify as a proud Scotsman. I have been coaching well over 10 years now, and I didn't go into coaching by design. My school team and the under 18 team I was part of at Inverleith didn't have a coach. So I stepped in as a player coach in both those situations, and it just grew from there. I'd say most of my coaching roles have followed that pattern and have come as the result of me stepping into some kind of vacancy that can't be filled. And definitely stepping in before I have the necessary experience and skills to actually do the role. So I think more often than not, in terms of my coaching journey, I've not felt maybe prepared for a new role, and it's been thrust upon me because someone's needed a coach and they can't find one. And I've put my hand up and said I'll give it a go. And I've had to take it on and just learn what good looks like on the job. But I like that challenge, and I think that's something that drives me as a coach. It's fun to take on a role where you know you're not prepared and you know you're going to have to figure things out on the job and learn. And it's fun because you feel a real sense of growth and also a real sense of achievement when you actually end up doing something good because you know you've had to really work to get to that point. And I think in the spirit of that, I'd say my spirit animal as a coach is Feathers McGraw, who's the penguin from Wallace and Gromit. And the moment that I have in my mind that links me to Feathers McGraw is that in one of the films, he and Gromit are on a model train, which is racing around a track. And there's a point where the track runs out and they have to frantically lay more track in front of them. And they have no idea where they're going. They're just trying to figure it out as they go. And I think that's, for me, a good analogy of how I feel as a coach that it's just the tracks ran out and you're just grabbing new pieces of track and laying them down in front of you and trying to test your way as to where you should go. And he's also a a penguin that's pretending to be a chicken, and I feel I'm often a man who's pretending to be a coach. So I think Fevers McGraw for his spirit of finding a way on a model train when you don't know where you're going, and also pretending to be something you're not, definitely is maybe a way to sum up me and my coaching journey.
Yeah, imposter syndrome is a weird thing, isn't it? I mean, we've all got knowledge that we can impart, but I think there's the confidence to do so, I think, holds a lot of people back from getting into coaching.
Definitely. I think my advice for people would be to accept the imperfection, accept the fact that you are developing your players, but you're also developing yourself, and you have to treat yourself with a bit of sympathy that I am developing here too. It's not just my players who are developing, but I'm here developing as a coach, and I need to act in that context, in that I'm not always going to get things right, and I need to give myself some sympathy and give myself a break, that if I don't get things right, then cool, it's okay. It's part of where I am in my journey, and we learn and we move on. So I think as a coach, you have a permission to get things wrong, and it doesn't often feel like that because everyone's looking to you to get things right, but you do have permission to get things wrong, and I think you should feel enabled to test and express yourself as a coach and feel enabled to fail, and learn from that.
Now, for someone who's got a lot of coaching experience, you are relatively young. You're still playing yourself at a first division level. How old are you?
I am 29 and actually turned 30 next week. And obviously, I have all the classic jitters about getting into my midlife. When it comes to coaching, I would definitely not say I am midlife in coaching or experienced in coaching. I still feel quite young in the coaching game. Most of my roles have come from being thrust into a job because there was a vacancy. Can you do this? They haven't come off the back of, years of courses and mentorship and opportunities and experience. They've come from someone needing to do the job. So I feel I've managed to get some pretty senior job titles, but off the back of need rather than want. And I feel that my experience is still building to a place where it actually matches the coaching CV I have. So although I am approaching my middle-aged years, I still feel quite a young coach, and one who's definitely got a long way to go before I would be happy to say I'm an experienced coach and who knows what they're doing.
The Half Court Press is on social media. Feel free to follow us on Facebook, X, Twitter, Instagram, and Threads. You can also subscribe to our YouTube channel.
This leads us nicely into our next section, coaching. What do you see as your role as a hockey coach? What are the important qualities of a coach? And does your role change between your different jobs?
In terms of the role of a coach, I believe in every context, the first job of a coach is engagement. You have to engage your players in that they are enjoying themselves. And gaining engagement obviously looks different for an under eight program to a senior international program, but the end objective is the same in that players are engaged and they're staying engaged. And I think coaches, your first responsibility is to foster that engagement. In terms of getting engagement, things that I try to keep at the front of my mind is I think players are engaged when they feel connected to the team or the club they represent or the organization they represent. If you feel connected, I think it fosters a greater engagement. If you feel successful and competent at what you're doing, it fosters engagement. So trying to help players set goals and achieve goals, making sure when you plan training sessions, you're thinking about the success and failure ratio in that session. Are players feeling enough success? Because if they're constantly feeling failure, then their engagement's going to drop. Positive reinforcement, trying to catch them doing things good and trying to build them up as players. Giving people a sense of autonomy and control, I think, is a big part of engagement. When people feel ownership or feel like they have the ability to take ownership, I think their engagement grows because they get a sense of this is mine. I can control this and I can shape this. And I think that inspires them to get involved and stay involved. So trying to have player-led moments as much as possible, offering non-controlling feedback. So the coach, rather than saying, you need to do this, this, and this, pose it as more of a discussion. And they have the autonomy in the feedback loop to object, to discuss, to put their point of view across. So yeah, making sure people feel autonomy and control, making sure people feel respected. I think if people don't feel respected, they're not going to engage, and people don't want to engage environments where they don't feel that their efforts and their person is respected. I think explaining the why is important. I think engagement comes off the back of things feeling valuable. You know, probably always all been there in a training session where you're doing something, you don't really see how this connects to you or the team getting better. So I think if everything has a clear why, it fosters engagement, injecting a sense of fun and playfulness when you can. And I think that works at all levels. For example, last night, the ladies' ones session I was part of, we had a 7v7 game with a floater, and one team of seven were the Kansas City Chiefs, one team of seven were the San Francisco 49ers. We dubbed the whole thing the Super Bowl, and the floating player was Taylor Swift. And it's just a micro bit of playfulness, but I think having a bit of playfulness when you can in a program does foster engagement. Try to have fun. And then, to be honest, quite simply, when it comes to engagement, align your training methods to what players enjoy. So again, going back to our ladies' ones, you know, we know they enjoy games and playing games. They enjoy drills that they feel at the end of that they've worked really hard. They enjoy drills that they can see a connection to the game. So we know as a coaching team that to get their engagement, we need to do a lot of games. We need to make sure things are intense and the girls feel like they're working. And we need to make sure everything has a clear why and is representative of the game. And if we do that, we have a training program that will foster engagement. But I think before we think about winning and other different success metrics, for me, the first job of a coach is engagement. You've got to have a squad that are enjoying what they're doing. They want to come back. And to be honest, if you just achieve that, then I think you've done a hell of a job. And anything else is a bonus. Engagement for me, number one role of a coach.
The buzzword, the popular terminology, I suppose, isn't it, is getting players to buy into a culture, buy into an idea. And this is another way of describing the same thing, perhaps.
Yeah, I think in terms of buy-in, it's so important for a program that players feel that it's something they want to invest in. And I think engagement is a bedrock of that. If they're not engaged in that, they don't enjoy the training methods, they don't feel connected to their teammates and to the club, and they don't feel like the program really represents what they want to do, they don't feel respected, they don't feel engaged for what could be a number of different reasons, then they're not going to buy in. And if players don't buy in, I guess the short of it is they don't turn up. And then if they don't turn up, you don't have a squad, and then you don't have a program, and then all other types of success are not going to follow.
What is your coaching style and how does that compare to other coaches?
Good question. Good question. What is my coaching style? Emerging, evolving, definitely is what I'd headline this with, in that I think I'm still trying to figure out who I am as a coach. I would say that personal connections is a key part of my style. You know, I try to make a personal connection with every player and be really deliberate about doing that. I have a rule that I try to spend 10 non-hockey seconds with every player as much as possible, because I enjoy doing it. I enjoy building relationships with people because your connection to people is what makes the places you spend your time much richer. So I enjoy doing it. But I also think it's fundamental to being a good coach for many reasons. I think if you build a good personal connection with players, it supports a healthier feedback loop. I mean, imagine if I don't build a personal connection with you, and we only talk about hockey, I think it can very quickly end up in a situation where our interaction is almost exclusively me calling you out for performance. And then that understandably leads to players believing that you just don't like them, and they naturally become closed to your feedback and negative towards you. Whereas if I also build a personal connection with you outside that feedback loop, you know, when I call you out, it's just hockey, it's not personal. and those feedback moments are then processed as purely a conversation about hockey. So I think if you don't have the personal connection when it comes to delivering feedback, people can sometimes start to feel that the coach doesn't like them, or the coach has favorites, or the coach is being too harsh. And that's totally fair, because their interaction with you is they're just processing you constantly calling them out for performance, and they've got nothing to offset that with. So I think if you build a strong personal connection with players, they know that the feedback is just feedback and it's not representative of your relationship. I also think if they have a good relationship with you, they're going to be more open to receiving feedback from you, because they enjoy the conversation with you, they enjoy the connection with you, and they're going to be more open to talking to you. And they'll probably feel safer around you as well, in terms of being able to share a feedback loop. I know that Tom understands me, I can be vulnerable here, I can share my thoughts, I can share my feelings. So I think making a personal connection for a number of reasons promotes a healthier feedback loop. I also think connecting with each other does what it says on the tin, and it fosters a feeling of connection. And we've just spoke about engagement, and I think if you do make that connection with each of your players, I think it does foster their engagement with the environment, and it can be part of building that picture of engagement. And yeah, for many reasons, and definitely more than what I've just rattled off, I think being a coach who is relationship driven is absolutely fundamental. In terms of other features of my style as a coach, attacking. I like attacking hockey, and I'm trying to learn how to coach it. So I bias my thinking to trying to be attacking. So for example, if I'm thinking about how my team is going to build up, I'm trying to think about how can I be as attacking as possible against the structures the opposition are putting in front of us. How can we build up with as few players as possible and have as many players as possible high up the pitch in attacking positions to create a real threat to their goal? So just loads of micro examples like that, where I try and ask myself, what is the most attacking thing we can do here, and try to go after that. I think another feature is that I am a principle-led coach. And this is something I inherited from Chris Duncan, who is now the Scotland senior women's head coach. And he coached the team I played in for a number of seasons. A principle is a rule that guides your decision-making in gameplay. And it is basically, we're giving players a simple set of rules to apply to their game that hopefully promote the types of decisions that you want to see. And I guess the logic is that without rules, if you don't set rules for decision-making, how can you expect anything but inconsistency and chaos, and potentially decision-making, which is against the style of play that you want to try and foster in the squad. So I've taken this on, and I try to have, at the very least, a clear master set of principles for individuals, both in and out of possession, so that I'm trying to help them drive the decision-making we want to promote in all phases of the game. And maybe just to use an example, for the ladies one side that I co-coach, we want to play exciting attacking hockey. So our emphasis is on being as attacking as possible in and out of possession. One of our in possession principles is the phrase find an option. So that simply means that when you're on the ball, you are accountable for keeping it until you find an option that is positive for our team. But we then combine that with the principle forward first. So when looking for an option, look forward first. And if there is a good option to go forward, you take it. But if you can't find an option to go forward, you then look sideways or backwards for an option. And the essence of what we want to see from every player is that they take every opportunity to advance the ball and every opportunity to go forward. But we want them to show the control that when it's not on, that they look for a solution elsewhere. They look sideways, they look backwards. And I think that balance is the base decision-making required for attacking hockey, which we want to play. We need players who balance control and release. They release forward as much as possible, but recognize when we can and we need to exercise a bit of control. So those two simple principles, and find an option, look forward first, which any player can understand, and that it's, you know, primary school language, hopefully gives players a clear prompt that helps them try and find that balance in the game we're looking for. It primes them to look forward as much as possible, but it also primes them to recognize when we have to show some control and play through a few more phases.
I talk a lot about height, width and depth with the kids. You know, where's the center forward? If you can't find the center forwards, where's the wingers? If you can't find the wingers, where's the sweeper?
That's another great way of articulating, I guess, the same mindset of we want to go forward first. And in terms of going forward first, I'm trying to develop as a coach to try and be someone who can, you know, identify how do we go forward? What is a good forward opportunity? And that's definitely an area of development for me. I'm trying to understand in the game what a good forward opportunity looks like and trying to, with our squad, develop an understanding of when can we go? What does that look like? And when do we need to find an option elsewhere? Hi, this is Tom Barton of Inverleith Hockey Club and the Cyprus Senior Men's National Team. And you are listening to the Half Court Press podcast with Teo McLeod. I think in terms of creating options for a team, I think another feature of my style is I quite like the concept of positional play, in that the idea that we instruct players to take up positions on the pitch that help their side in possession, either because the positions that we've taken up create an overload, they introduce numbers to part of the pitch, or potentially it leaves a player in a 1v1 in space somewhere that we can maybe switch the ball to, or it maybe leaves a player with a key skill in a position where they can exploit and leverage that skill. So using positions to create advantage in the game is something that I'm trying to test myself with. So when we think about how do we set up in different phases of the game tactically, I'm trying to think about what are the positions that we want to take up in order to create an advantage of some sort, whether that's numbers or technical superiority, that we've got a player matched up against a player and that's going to be a good matchup for us, etc. So trying to find some kind of advantage through our positioning is something that I also put quite a bit of focus on. And I'd say maybe the final thing I'd chuck in as another element that I think is quite key to my style as a coach is that I feel I am quite focused on the psychosocial influence on performance. I'm very focused on making sure players have a strong toolbox of tricks to help them get in the right mindset for a game. I talk a lot about pressure in games and how we often get distracted from good decision making by pressure, and try and instill some tips and tricks for players to get them back to an optimum mindset. Someone I have looked a lot into is a sports psychologist called Kerry Evans, who was a sports psychologist with the All Blacks, and he had an intervention with them where they had gone for a number of years being world number one but not winning the World Cup. And I think it was something like 20 years, they hadn't won the World Cup, but they'd been world number one. And he had an intervention with them around, well, how do we handle that pressure? How do we handle the pressure of big games and stay in the right mindset? And he explains that performance is like a wave and that there's always going to be peaks and troughs. And when we're in a trough, we have to step back, focus on our tasks, focus on what's the right energy for this moment, and then step up with that desired energy and focus, and then stay in at that level. So in terms of my focus from a psychosocial point of view, I really try and focus on making sure we've got a good toolbox for those trough moments. And as a squad, if we are under a lot of pressure, we all have the ability to recognize that we're under pressure, recognize that we're in a trough, and then have an optimum mindset to refocus on, step towards, and then hold on to. So I think having that understanding of what a good mindset looks like in the game and being able to recognize maybe when we've deviated from that, and then being able to step back, recognize, and then step into a better mindset is something that I put a lot of importance on in terms of managing the ebbs and flows of a game. Yeah, I would say that's maybe a summary of some of the key features of what I feel maybe repeat themselves in my coaching, and what I'd maybe start to put down as a sort of style statement for things that I think are important to me as a coach.
Now, in that, you've also answered the next question of what are your philosophies and principles as well. So you've got two in one question and answer there, I think.
No, like a value for money.
I'm interested in how you would put that across in a practical sense. So how would you coach that to the team, and how would you coach that to the individual? And is there a difference?
Yeah. So in terms of coaching the group, I think the starting point is that the group have a shared mental model of what we're trying to do as a group. You can't have, well, it's not a group if you've got a set of individuals all thinking different things about why are we playing, how do we want to play. So I think from a group level, we need to start with what is the end in mind for the group? What are the objectives of this team? What are we looking to achieve? How do we want to behave as a group in relation to behaviors that will drive us towards our objectives, but also just what behaviors are true to who we want to be as an organization or as a team? And then we also need to have an understanding of what is the type of hockey we want to play. So I think starting with a really clear end in mind, what are our objectives? What is our culture? And what is our playing style? And then from a taking the playing style and then drilling that down into a real shared mental model of what we want to do tactically in different phases of the game. So we've got a clear master plan for what we would like to do in different phases, you know, when we're pressing, when we're building up, and we've got high possession in transition moments, what are we looking to do? And what are the roles within those tactics? So making sure the team have got a real clear mental model of, as a group, this is what we're trying to do tactically in different phases of the game, and have a clear understanding of the different roles in those tactics and what other people are doing.
Like a jigsaw,
Like a
no.
jigsaw, definitely. I think that's such a really great analogy. I think you can't have everyone holding a piece of a jigsaw which doesn't fit together, and you know, everyone's got a piece from a different box. You know, you need everyone to have the shared picture, and yeah, start with where we want to go. And then when it comes to the hockey, we need to have a shared mental model of what we're trying to do on the pitch. What is our playing style? What are our key tactics? What are the key roles for individuals within those tactics and those different instructions we're trying to deliver as a team? I think also we need to consider at a group level, we've now got an idea of what we want to do. We know what we want to achieve as a team. And we know what kind of culture we might want to have. We know what kind of playing style we want. We know what kind of tactics we want to have on the pitch. So we know a lot about us and what we're trying to do. We then need to identify, well, we know what we want to do. Well, how are we going to work together effectively to make it happen? And I think that's where teamwork comes in. I think at a group level, you have to coach teamwork. So, you know, emotional understanding. So understanding each other emotionally. How do people like to be worked with? How do people like to be engaged with? How can I get the best out of my teammates? We know what we want to do, but how can I best emotionally work with each other? And a hockey understanding in that we know what we want to do as a group on the pitch. What, how do we work together as hockey players? It is a nice concept of red squares and blue circles. No, blue squares and red circles, where a blue square is a player who is very controlled, safety orientated, makes safe decisions, doesn't take risks. And a red circle is someone who takes risks and is maybe a little bit more dangerous in terms of their decision making, a little bit more carefree. And I think we need to understand what are the types of players we have in our team so we can predict their decision making, so we can effectively work with them on the pitch and make sure that we are aligned to what we think they're going to do next, so we can then support that next action, and also so we can encourage them to take up the most effective role for the team based on how they like to play. So I think, yeah, from a coaching a group point of view, you need to start with understanding what we want to achieve as a group on and off the pitch, and then you need to understand how are we going to work together to achieve that picture. When it comes to the individual, I'm a big believer that you are creating a player for a role. You're not creating a Swiss Army knife who can do everything. You're creating a player for a role. And I think players need a clear role profile, which is focused on their strengths. You are good at X, Y, and Z. So I think you can really deliver on this role for the team. And in relation to that role, develop a really clear match script for them, which is a term that I've stolen from, there's a sports psychologist called Dan Abrahams, who I'd recommend anyone listens to. And he talks about the idea of coming up with a match script, which is basically a list of kind of, for my role, these are my key tasks. And it's a sort of a mental toolbox trick where I've got this match script that I can keep returning to in my head to really refocus me on what are the important things for my role. So give players a role which aligns to their strengths, help them come up with a match script for that role. And in terms of their development, you know, we're looking to identify things which are going to enhance their match script and make them better at their match script. And that's when we look at individual development plans, we're looking to develop players' performance against their match script and make them better at delivering that. So, you know, looking at the physical, technical, decision-making elements that will enhance the match script. And that is sort of the main focus for me on individual development.
Now, the last question of this section, how do you improve as a coach?
Curiosity. I think you need to be curious to improve, curious about how other teams play. When you watch teams, try and think about it. How are they doing things? How are they solving problems? Look at teams in other sports and how they solve similar problems. So, you know, for example, if you look at ice hockey, there's some great examples of 1v1 defense in ice hockey and how players solve that problem. And you can take some of that logic to field hockey. You look at American football and how a team's offense try and get a player free in space beyond the defense and try and punch through that defensive line. And I've been taking a lot of thoughts recently as to how can we use that to maybe think about set plays in and around the D. How can we, you know, NFL, American football is, you know, based on set plays and teams running set plays. You know, can we take that logic to our dead ball situations near the opposition D? Can we run set plays that allow a player to be found free or allow a player to run through the opposition with the ball to get a shot? So I think looking, being curious about other sports and how, you know, teams solve problems in other sports, and is there anything you can transfer to your sport? Being curious about what other coaches do. If anyone that I'm in a team with or coaching with is coaching with or being coached by another coach who's of a level, I always say, what are they like? What do they like to focus on? What does their training sessions look like? And I try and get really curious about what they do. So I think curiosity, you know, watch other hockey teams, watch other sports, ask people about what other coaches are doing and just see what you can take and inspire for your own practice.
The Half Court Press is a multi-sport media outlet. You can check out our articles, opinion pieces and PDF magazines on our website, www.halfcourtpressmagazine.com.
Now, moving on to the third section of the interview, youth and senior coaching, domestic and international coaching. Chatting a bit more about your various roles within hockey. This is a bit more tailored towards you. Can you tell us a bit more about the similarities and differences between coaching youth hockey and senior hockey players and teams?
Yeah. Well, I think from, as a starting point, when it comes to looking at players, I'm very big on, we don't look at age, we look at stage, and we try and manage players through stages rather than ages, in that it's a question of what are your capabilities and then rather than how old you are. So
someone who started playing at the age of 3 or 5 will have a very different experience at age 15 than someone who's been playing for 6 months.
Totally. And I think people develop at different rates for different reasons. And I think we need to coach people based on their stage rather than their age or their CV and what teams they've been involved in. You know, where are they today in terms of their stage? And I think in terms of thinking about that, when we look at the first stages of someone's development, which for me are more associated with youth hockey, I think we start off initially with sort of me in the ball is the bucket I've got for early years coaching, and it's really looking at technical skills in possession and attacking decision making. So it's you on the ball. Everything's about you on the ball. And I think under eights, under 10s, under 12s, it's me in the ball. It's your technical skills on the ball and it's your decision-making on the ball. When we start getting into under 12s, under 14s, it's about developing an all-round player in the sense that we're adding in defensive technical skills and defensive decision-making. So by the time they get to 12, 13, they're hopefully a player who is quite a well-rounded player as an individual in that they've got, you know, a good understanding of attacking and defensive decision-making, and they have a good set of attacking and defensive technical skills. When they get past 13, 14, 15, 16 and into adult hockey, it's about developing them as a team player. So understanding a role in a team, performing a role in a team. And this is usually where you introduce them to 11-a-side hockey. And it's about understanding roles in 11-a-side hockey. Whereas before this point, it's just them as an individual player rather than a player in a team and a system. When you get to adult hockey and later years youth hockey, it's about developing them as team player. And we, you know, we still drive individual skill development and individual decision making and, you know, developing that. But I think there's a big focus on driving their understanding of how to play as part of a team. So I would say that's maybe in terms of looking at youth hockey and adult hockey from a content point of view, a lot of youth hockey for me should be focused on them as an individual, developing attacking and defensive decision making, attacking and defensive technical skills. And then as they get older and approach adult hockey, this is where we learn to play in an 11-a-side team, understand roles in an 11-a-side team, and we're driving our development as a player in an 11-a-side team.
So at Inverleith, I'm coaching a lot of the less experienced players, especially at under 14s. I've got the 12-year-olds who've just come up who are turning 13 during the course of the season. And they may have been taught some very good technical skills, but they haven't got much of an idea of how to then use that in a team-based situation, how to use that against one or more defenders, how to use that with one or more teammates, and what to do off the ball, tactical decision-making. So this is why I think that game-based situations, 2v2s, 3v3s, 4v4s, 6v6s, small size of games, are important to then get to chat to them about tactical decision-making, group decisions, verbal and non-verbal communications.
I mean, I place a lot of importance on learning through the game for a number of reasons. First of all, it's the most fun way to learn the game is to play the game. And it's the best way to get engagement is to play games. Players get lots of touches. They feel a sense of competition. It drives engagement, which is going to drive learning. I also think that it forces players to understand not just the skills and the decisions, but what are the cues for using skills and making decisions. You know, when we're in isolated practice, which is definitely a time and a place for, you're operating in an environment where you are just doing a skill or making a decision without a game cue. And there's a bit of a jump to then input that into a game because you've practiced it out with the game. So you might not recognize the opportunities to use or not use that skill or that decision. So I think by trying to learn stuff through the game, it means you learn the skill or you learn the sort of decision-making principle, but you also learn it in an environment where you're learning what are the cues and you're looking and feeling and recognizing the cues for doing that. So I think it's, yeah, learning through the game means you learn the skill or the decision and the cues, which that's the complete package. And it is more fun, more engaging for the players involved.
When he does this, I do that. When she does that, I do this.
100%. And I think often drills and isolated practice sometimes don't deliver that game realism. And the only way to get it is to play a game. So I think
you can talk about those conditions. You can still add stuff or try and create, as a technical director once used the term random repetition, to create a method of... if you want to focus on passing, you create situations where players are passing but in different angles all the time. So short or long, push or sweep, hit or slap. And so at different angles and different distances and in different directions. And to try to create a situation where that happens a lot in different situations.
I also think that from a club point of view, you know, we've got a lot of amateur coaches, myself included. And I think, you know, sometimes the game takes pressure away from coaches in that if we put kids into a game, the game's there, the game's the teacher. You know, they're playing the game, they're getting forced to make decisions in the game, they're being forced to execute skills in the game, and the game is teaching them. And it means when we've got, you know, low experience volunteers, low experience coaches, it puts less pressure on them because the game is teaching. So I think it's a great tool for a grassroots club in a very amateur situation, in that if you make more use of the game, it takes pressure off potentially quite an amateur workforce. I mean, that you're leaning on the game to do the teaching rather than really pressuring the skills of, you know, volunteers and quite inexperienced coaches.
Well, this leads us nicely into the next question of what are the similarities and differences? What are the similarities and differences between coaching domestic clubs, grassroots clubs, elite level clubs, and coaching international players and teams and groups?
Well, I mean, the first thing is contact time. The international program, depending on your budget, I think even programs with a high budget, you know, you get far less contact time with players in an international program than you do in a club program. Club program is weekly. International program is, you know, the very best, you know, bi-weekly, monthly. It's got more gaps in between. And as you go down the scale of budget, it can potentially be that you only meet up a couple of times a year. So if you look at something like the GB program and their centralized program, obviously those girls and men get a lot of contact time with the GB coaches. But as soon as you step away from that level of budget, the contact time drops drastically, and you definitely get a lot more contact time at a club level than you do an international level. And that obviously puts a challenge on your coaching. And in terms of resolving that problem, you have to look at stuff like remote learning. How can you coach players in your squad when you're not with them? How can you make sure that they've got clear goals, clear objectives to be working on as an individual when they attend their club sessions and their club matches, making sure they've got a really clear individual development plan. They're reflecting on their game, setting goals, achieving goals, and trying to drive their development as an athlete in isolation from the national program. And, you know, you're really trying to foster that remote learning. You know, whereas from a club point of view, you've got your players weekly, and, you know, a lot of it can be coach-led if you want it to be coach-led, because you can have conversations weekly with players. Whereas in an international point of view, a lot of it has to be athlete-led, because they are off in their own program where they have to lead themselves and lead their sort of individual development plan because you're not there.
I mean, that's an interesting point in terms of contact time, in terms of the assumption of the more traditional format of club and international hockey. In Germany, I think they follow that idea, that similarly in Holland as well, where the clubs pay the money, the players have the contracts with the clubs. So they're professional athletes through the clubs, and then they get selected for the international teams. In England and Great Britain, the England GB players are contracted to the international programme through lottery funding. It's a centralised programme. And then they get released to the clubs. So it's a different format to train them. So the international teams have the more contact time with the players than the clubs do.
It's very context dependent. I think the question, what's the difference between international and domestic coaching, is driven by context. Obviously, top nations with big budgets can foster a lot of contact time with players and give players a lot of support. Smaller nations with smaller budgets, less contact time, less support available. And, you know, there's bigger gaps in terms of interventions from a program with players. I think contact time is a variable.
And below the FIH world ranking of 20, you tend to get very much amateur-based players as well, don't you?
Well, I think that's it's key as well in terms of the types of players that are involved. I think at a club level, you're definitely dealing mostly with amateur players, and that comes with an amateur level of commitment, quite rightly. You know, these players have jobs, they have families, they have social lives that they need to balance with their program. And then I think, as you said, as you scale up to smaller nations and smaller programs, that continues into the international scene, that you are coaching international players, but they're still amateur players, and they're not paid to do this. They have lives, they have work, and they have other motivations that need balanced. And I think there's some similarities there between an amateur club program and basically an amateur international program, where you're dealing with amateur athletes. And it's only when you get to this sort of GB programs where it's full-time centralized contracts that you can really start saying that these individuals are full-time players, and therefore you can expect a different level of commitment and motivation from them and investment in them than you can from amateur players.
How do you prepare a team and players in the short term and long term for competition? What training methods do you use?
Well, in the short term, I think the things that make the biggest impact are players' physical conditions, so trying to get people as fit as possible, and tactics, so making sure the team as a group is organized to try and do something in different phases of the game. So we have an organized approach to build up, we have an organized approach to pressing, we have an organized approach to high transfer and high possession, we have an organized approach to counter pressing and what that looks like for us. So making sure that we've got a clear tactical understanding for all the phases of the game, and we're in good physical condition. And I think if you want a short-term impact, that's the first box is to tick. In terms of a long-term impact, you're then looking to build up players' technical abilities over a longer time frame. So looking at instilling technical capabilities which are going to enhance how they play. So looking at ball carrying position and how that can be improved, and how that can then impact the hockey they play from an in possession point of view, looking at their ability to play the ball and how that can affect their distribution and their ability to shoot. So over the long term, trying to layer in technical improvements, having over a longer term period as well, trying to drive an improvement on mindset. So helping players over a longer period develop a kind of psychological toolbox of, tips and tricks for how they can get themselves in an optimum state to compete. So a couple of references to chuck in. Dan Abrahams, who's a sports psychologist, has a concept called game face and a concept called match script. And so as we've referenced, match script is basically a summary of the tasks that you're going to do in the game, and you can keep going back to that. All right, these are my tasks. These are my tasks. I'm going to refocus on that. And game face is around the kind of the energy and behaviors you want to bring to the game. What game face am I going to wear? Am I intense, aggressive? Am I controlled? Am I safe? What words, what adjectives do I associate with a good mindset for me? And you can then return to that game face. So I think over a longer period, you can start trying to develop that with players. And then also, as we mentioned earlier in the pod, around trying to develop principles for decision making, having over a longer term, we can develop principles for being in possession, being out of possession, which help drive optimal decision making in the situations we find ourselves in. So, but yeah, short term tactics, physical condition, longer term technical excellence, mindset, there's principles for decision making, and looking to embed that in over a longer period.
How do you create a positive culture?
Positive culture. I think, first of all, I mean, what is a positive culture? For me, a positive culture is one where we are primed to connect with each other and show a real intense togetherness. I think if you're together as a squad, it fosters engagement. If people feel connected, included, welcomed in an environment, they're more likely to turn up and they're more likely to invest. I also think as a sports club, as a sports team, at any level, it is our duty to create connected environments, rich in relationships for the good of the people in the team. In that, if we create a nice connected environment for that 20, 30 people involved in that program, they're going to have a great experience because they're going to enjoy an environment rich in relationships. But I also think there's a sense of duty connected to the fact that if through our culture, we can educate people on what a connected environment looks like, what builds a connected environment, what brings people together, they can hopefully pass those learned behaviors on and you know, pass them on to other environments, their work environment, other teams they're part of, teams they go on to be part of in the future. So I think, yeah, I think if, you know, trying to build togetherness because it fosters engagement, but I also think, you know, for the good of the players involved and also for the good of the environments that they can take this learning of togetherness to, we should try and be together. And I think the other part of a good performance culture is competitiveness and, you know, being there to compete. And I think the core behavior behind that is around, you know, everything to do with being the best. So, you know, being accountable for being the best when it comes to your intentions on the pitch, being really focused and playing with intent and reflecting on how you're performing and trying to bring an intent to improve and to perform and get better, to be the best in terms of attendance, be the best in terms of fitness, and be the best in terms of understanding your role. So I think for me, a good culture is this combination between connectedness and being primed and ready to compete. And to answer the question, how do you build a culture? For me, role models are key. People will copy role models. People set examples and people follow. One live example, Inverleith Ladies Ones trying to be big on connecting with each other for the reasons I've outlined, but also because, you know, we are a first team in what is famously a family club. So if we want to be a first team in a family club, you know, we need to act like a first team in a family club. And that obviously means that we show intense connectedness, togetherness to each other and the rest of the club. And in terms of trying to foster that, one behavior that we tried to role model was celebrating people's achievements. So taking every excuse, you know, someone's passed their driving test, someone's got a promotion at work, someone had a birthday, someone got engaged, making sure that we start the session or intervene in the session to say, hey, point of celebration, so-and-so's done this, and we all have a, you know, well done moment. So we were role modeling that. And then out of nowhere, one player who hadn't really been involved in this kind of deliberate attempt to celebrate took it upon themselves to say, hey, this player passed an exam, just want to say that. And everyone was like, yeah, well done. And I thought it's just such a nice example of how role modeling snowballs the behavior you want, and that player clearly saw us celebrating and was like, hey, that's what we do here and it feels good, so I'm going to do that. And they did it, and then that's hopefully inspiration for the next person to do it and the next person to do it. So I think, yeah, role modeling behavior. Another example I love is, you know, when, you know, you have an environment in a sort of team environment, is making sure that players in that environment try and make a connection with everyone in it. And Hearts Football Club had a sort of mantra that you kind of give a high five or a fist bump to everyone you pass in the Hearts environment. You know, if it's the kit man or an under 12 or a first team player, you give a wee fist bump. And I think that really fosters a moment of personal connection and it makes people feel connected, included. So, you know, we've been trying to model that behavior. And, you know, I've been in environments where, you know, people start doing that. And then the young players who've come into the squad, they then start doing that. And they approach the senior players who are role modeling the behavior and start fist bumping them and shaking their hands and saying, hello, how are you? Did you have a good day? And really building those moments of personal connection, which then build into feelings of, you know, connectedness as a squad. So yeah, I think being competitive, being together and trying to achieve that for people, role modeling behaviors.
How do you create a winning environment? And at what point does a winning mentality become necessary? So thinking about the journey from youth hockey to international hockey, at what point do you need to have a little bit more bite in terms of that mentality? And can a focus on winning ever be a negative?
I think for the majority of time, I focus on satisfaction rather than winning. Because winning is something which you can't control. You know, it can be influenced by umpiring decisions, mistakes, moments that are just completely out with your control. Whereas satisfaction, for me, you can view that as a whole host of things you can control. And I would rather have a focus on us judging ourselves based on things we can control. So for example, you know, the way we try to play a game, we say we want to be attacking, we say we want to live by exciting hockey and we want to put that style onto the pitch. Did we achieve that today? Can we be satisfied that we tried to be an attacking team? Can we be satisfied that we have created an environment where everyone felt able to express themselves and be confident on the pitch? Has a player who continually professes that they can't hit a reverse stick shot, have they tried a reverse stick shot in the game? And we can celebrate that because we've created a safe environment from a psychological point of view, an environment where people feel confident. Have we really showed the right level of mindset in the game? Have we been intense and energetic? Have we been really focused? Or have we been really lethargic, haven't been putting much effort in, haven't been really focused on our job? So rather than winning, I prefer to look at it through the lens of we want to be satisfied, and we can be satisfied if all the things within our control we've delivered on. Have we delivered on our style of play? Have we delivered on our mindset? Have we delivered on our connectedness as a group? Have we had a real connected moment pre-game or post-game? Have we delivered on those behaviours that we want to see as part of our off-pitch culture? So I think, yes, winning is ultimately important in sport, but I think in terms of evaluating the game, I'd rather start with the question, can we be satisfied? And then look at evaluating what can we control as an answer to that question. Can we be satisfied because everything within our control we have delivered on? And if we've won, we've won. If we've lost, we've lost. But we can be satisfied because we've delivered on everything that we want to deliver on. And the outcome is the outcome. And hopefully it's a good one. But if it's a bad one, we can still get a sense of satisfaction because we really have tried to live who we want to be and do the things we want to do.
The Half Court Press is on social media. Feel free to follow us on Facebook, X, Twitter, Instagram, and Threads. You can also subscribe to our YouTube channel.
As we begin to wind up, who or what inspired you to go into coaching?
Oh, it was completely non-planned, accidental. I think the question would be what's inspired me to stay in coaching? And, you know, my start was just, you know, the teams I was in needed a coach. My school team needed a coach. The club youth team I was in needed a coach. And I just stepped up. But in terms of why I've stayed in coaching, you know, I feel I get energy from working with people. I love building relationships with people. I love sharing environments with people and trying to achieve something together. I get a lot of energy from that sense of relationship building and sense of shared purpose, and we're all working towards having a good time together. I get a lot of energy from working with people. And I also, you know, find it a real intellectual challenge to how can I coach a team to do well on a pitch, and, you know, what goes into that, and trying to think through all the different layers and elements of what makes up a good performance and you know, also a good culture as well. You know, what makes a good performance on the pitch and off the pitch, and trying to build that is this nice intellectual challenge.
Who are your favourite coaches of all time? In hockey or sport in general?
Okay, favourite coaches of all time. I really like Gareth Southgate, the England football team manager, because I think he demonstrates in his management of that group a deep loyalty, real strong empathy to players and what they're going through in terms of issues at clubs, issues with their performance, issues in their social life. He demonstrates strong humility in relation to performance, and he shows that it's okay not to get things right all the time. And I think he encourages his players to feel safe on the world's biggest stage. I think he allows people to be safe because they know the manager's got their back. They know the manager has given them permission to make mistakes, and he puts his hand up and says, I've made a mistake here. And he allows people to be vulnerable and, you know, take a risk on making a mistake. So I think, yeah, they feel protected and supported and feel permission to act and play with less fear because the manager's got their back and the manager has given them permission to fail. I like Steve Kerr, the Golden State Warriors basketball head coach. I think from what I've seen of him, he really coaches from a positive. He really catches people doing things well, really builds up players, talks about what they can do. And I think that is such a strong trait in a coach. We talked about how the number one job of a coach is engagement. And I think people feeling successful and feeling good is key to that. And I think he instills that in his team by being positive. And I also think by being positive, he also enables players to take risks, in that he positively frames taking risks, and he gives people a psychologically safe environment to take risks because he's positively framed taking risks and has a positive narrative behind that. So I think he coaches from a positive in terms of, you know, his reinforcement of taking risks and his building up players. Pep Guardiola, you know, his introduction of an intensely focused game when it comes to positional play in possession, and how he is very deliberate with his formations and his structures in games, in that he is trying to build a structure on a pitch which gives his team an advantage in terms of numbers or player superiority in a position. And I think that is definitely an introduction to football from his mind, and it's now, you know, bleeding into sport globally. So probably say those three. Paul Revington, actually another one to bring it back to hockey. He's the GB men's head coach, and I just really like the fact that he's said that, I want to coach a team who, if you walked past them playing in the park, you would stop and watch for a moment. And they want to play exciting hockey that people want to watch. And, you know, that's something that I think speaks to my own personal ambition as a coach. So yeah, those four, I'd say.
Who are the best coaches that have trained you as a player?
Oh, well, I'm going to offend some people by forgetting them. In terms of coaches that have coached me that I think have been exceptional, there's a guy called Graham Dunlop, otherwise known as Cheesy. He was my coach at Scotland under 18 level when I was part of that squad. And I really just appreciated his intense man management of us as individuals. He really went out his way to check in with individuals, make sure people were okay. He told you how you were feeling just as you started to feel like that. So he was very predictive in his management. You're probably feeling nervous. That's normal. And I think he really fostered a really strong individual man management. He lots of points of connection with players, predicting how they were feeling, helping them discuss and manage those thoughts, giving them a clear focus for their development. So I think Graham was definitely a fantastic individual man manager in terms of making sure people felt connected to him, made sure people understood how they were feeling and were able to process that, made sure people had clear focus on their development. So I think he was an excellent individual coach. Graham Moody was my coach at Edinburgh University, and he was excellent at the team side of things. He was fantastic at making sure that the team had a really clear picture of how we wanted to play, and also was very good at making sure the team bought into that by having the team design that picture. You know, we had lots of preseason meetings where as a team, we designed how we want to play and therefore what it means for our training methods and how we want to train. And he was really good at fostering a team having a really clear picture of what do they want to achieve, how do they want to play, and also fostering the team to develop that. Chris Duncan, a really fantastic coach, definitely someone who opened my eyes to having a more principle-led approach to content and trying to summarize decision-making that you would like to see in the game through clear principles that players can remember. So I'd probably say those three in terms of coaches that have coached me. Another one to throw in is a coach called Stuart Neave, who coached me for a long time at Inverleith. And I think his man management of individuals in a squad environment, in terms of making sure that his players were felt valued and felt invested, I feel he's excellent at making sure that his dressing room is full of players who feel respected and feel motivated to be there. And I think, you know, a lot of people would say the phrase that they would run through a brick wall for Stu. And I think he, for me, is a role model because he makes you feel respected and he makes you feel like your involvement is important. And I think that fosters engagement. And I also think as a man, he just put so much into the team and so much into the club that you want to work for him because he's working for you. So I'd say Stu is an example of, you know, if you work hard as a coach, people will work hard for you. And also if you make people feel respected and important, they will work hard for you. So I'd say yeah, those four or five names there.
Who are the best coaches that you've coached with?
Ooh. Taylor McLeod?
Thank you very much.
I would say some of the best coaches I've coached with. I mean, this is a hard question because a lot of my coaching is done in isolation, which has been one of the biggest, I think, drawbacks to my development in that I think the world of amateur hockey is that teams are thankful to have a coach and you're rarely in a situation where you have multiple coaches. So you often find yourself working on your own. In terms of coaches that I've worked with, I really love working with a coach called Paul Taylor. Me and him have been coaching together in various capacities for the best part of a decade now. And I think in terms of why do I like working with Paul? I like working with Paul because first and foremost, we connect as two great mates. And I think it's just a great example of you work well with people that you're able to foster a connection with. So I really enjoy working with Paul because together we've fostered a strong connection. I also enjoy working with Paul because he doesn't mince his words and he tells me when things aren't good enough. He tells me when things are good. And I think he is a strong challenger to my thinking, which, you know, which I enjoy. And, you know, likewise, I also have to, you know, the guys I work with in terms of coaching our ladies ones at the moment, Sean Stewart, Greg McKenzie, Ben Gibb. I feel that I value working with them because they're also challengers. They challenge me. They tell me when I'm being stupid. They tell me when an idea is good. They build me up and they knock me down. So yeah, I'd say in terms of coaches I've worked with, I'd say one key trait that I've enjoyed is the ability for us to connect and another to be their challenger mindset, that they're going to challenge me and build me up, and both in equal measure.
Last question. Who are your favourite coaches currently working in hockey?
Well, I mentioned Paul Revington. I really like him as a coach. I just love the statement that I want to have a team that if you were walking past us in the park, you'd at least stop for a moment and watch what we're doing. So I think Paul Revington for that, you know, attacking statement. In terms of other coaches in the game, I've got a lot of respect for a number of people in terms of what I've seen their international teams do or club teams do, but I don't really have access to them as a coach. So it's really hard to comment on them as a coach because you don't get a lot of profiling of what are they doing with their team? How do they conduct themselves? You know, a lot of the coaches I mentioned in terms of people I respect are ones that do countless interviews, you know, Netflix series on them, and you get a lot of insight into what they do in their practice. I think in the world of hockey, it's quite hard to have coaching role models because, you know, for example, I know that Max Caldas is the coach of Spain at the moment, was the coach of the Netherlands, has won a lot, but I don't know much about his practice and what he does. So it's hard. I think it's hard to have hockey coaching role models because you don't get a lot of exposure to the greats of the game and exactly what they do.
Max Caldas is one of the Half Court Press magazine's top iconic hockey coaches of all time.
Ah, oh, there we go.
After this interview comes out, there will be another member of the Half Court Press magazine iconic coaches of all time coming out as part of this series. Stay tuned for that special guest. Tom Barton of Inverleaf Hockey Club and the Cypriot men's hockey team. Thank you so much.
No, thank you, Ter. I've enjoyed that. I think I've enjoyed trying to articulate my coaching, and I've probably done so in a very rambly, chaotic way, but I've enjoyed that challenge trying to make sense of my own practice. And I think it's definitely given me a nice bit of clarity on some of the things that I think are important. So thank you for pushing me through this coach development process of trying to talk about my game.
And to the surprise of everybody within Scottish hockey, it has been recorded in under 7 hours.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, well, I think you released the shortcut and we can maybe do the director's extended cut later for Half Court Press subscribers. They can get the full 7 hours.
Tom, thank you so much.
No problem, Tia.
This has been a Half Court Press production by Teo McLeod. If you've enjoyed this show, then please leave us a rating and a review wherever you listen to your podcasts and on Facebook.